is simple perfection. There's nothing that's harder to find. Someone to lead us, protect us and feed us, and help us to make up our minds. We need a man that's sophisticated, quiet and strong and well educated. Where to go? What to do? Could it be somebody super like you?
Well, okay. Here we are in only the second month in this new year of our Lord 2013, and already the homosexual prayers have been answered. Apparently all the time spent on their knees has done some good, because it is official now. Queers of all shapes and sizes are now able to get married legally here in Illinois. So celebrations are in order. Congrats! And now may your lives be as fucking miserable as your hetero brethren and sistren. Oh, pot is becoming legal in more and more states. Gays are getting hitched. Conceal and carry has passed, and popes are bailing on a sinking ship. Holy hell, did the rapture actually happen? Is this heaven on earth? Are things coming together and shaping up for my ultimate takeover as I grab the reins of power? All I can say is the Nuge better take heed, because he's the first fucker I'm coming after. We'll be right back. All right now. You know, for years and years, people have been writing on the concept of power struggles, new world orders, brave new worlds. So the topic is nothing new. But some did it with such elan that they completely changed my way of thinking about the genre of science fiction. Obviously, the paranoid, jackbooted governmental societies created by Huxley and Orwell and Bradbury influenced many in the field. The drug and theologically induced hallucinatory worlds of Philip K. Dick fucked my teenage mind into submission, conceding the notion that there may be more to everything than just the physical and empirical. Even Kurt Vonnegut, though not necessarily known as a sci-fi writer, drew up fantasy societies that are astonishingly accurate to today's world, and, in my opinion, created one of the best anti-heroes ever in Billy the Poet. Now that fella had an agenda I could get behind. But it wasn't until I discovered Samuel Delaney that my idea of sci-fi completely changed. Like many, I knew of the escapist theater of laser guns, robots, and little green men. But Delaney's work divided the genre like a mutant cell before my very eyes. For the first time, I saw it as a polymorphous, perverse landscape in which the limits of human potential could be stretched and condensed to infinity. As America's first openly gay and openly I was just about to say openly black. Like what, it was a fucking secret? Like I just outed him. Until now, nobody knew he was black. But I just blew it. What a fucking asshole. Why do you people listen to me? Anyway, as America's first black and openly gay science fiction writer, Samuel Delaney, along with others like Joanna Russ and Octavia Butler, showed me the striking ways in which fantastical other worlds could be used to interrogate our own culture's concepts of gender, sexuality, and race. Delaney's works include Nova, Babel 17, The Einstein Intersection, Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders, and others. Now, if you're unfamiliar with him and the others I have mentioned, I highly recommend going and checking them out. Meanwhile, I'm gonna go shove my head in a fucking microwave.
Off into a separate room. I seen him taking different people off, different ones of us off in separate rooms. And they put me on a big white table. And the guy that to take me in there, the one of them that took me in there to examine me, I guess, he probed me. And then I was in there, I bet more than 3 or 4 hours in that room of being probed. And at one time or another, there's different ones of them come in, 4, 5, 6 of them at different times, and all of them probed me. Not all at once, you know, individually. Later on, years later, now even still, it's a funny thing. It happened on a Sunday, and every Sunday, about the time that I was taken on board that ship, I find I have no feelings in my buttocks.
So as we were saying, science fiction that deals with not necessarily your stereotypical sci-fi adventures with spaceships and aliens, but rather a dystopian look at a futuristic world dealing with more psychological, social, and political themes. And one of the best examples of this and widely known styles of this type is A Clockwork Orange, written by Anthony Burgess, movie by Stanley Kubrick. Now, when I first saw this movie on late night cable, my adolescent mind was blown. I hardly had the capacity to even begin to scratch the surface of what was going on here. But I knew it was good. Just like when I picked up one of my dad's Playboys when I was a wee lad. Didn't know why I was getting tingly all over, but I knew I liked it. And this is one of the rare examples where the book and the film are almost interchangeable. A few twists and turns aside, the screenplay reads like the novel. Or so we thought. At least us here in the U.S. In the original 1962 UK edition, the book had 21 chapters, with the original concept being Burgess wanted to divide the book into three parts, 7 chapters each. But US publishers didn't like that. So Burgess reluctantly agreed to change the format and drop the last or 21st chapter. Hence, until 1987, the book had 20 chapters in the US. And us ignorant dweebs who wandered the earth aimlessly without benefit of internet or 24-hour news or scandals or who gives a fuck bullshit feeds were none the wiser. But on the book's 25th anniversary in 1987, the chapter was restored and published here in the U.S. for the first time. I remember going to the bookstore and seeing this on the shelves and almost soiling my shorts then and there. I had heard rumors about this mysterious 21st chapter, but passed it off as urban legend, you know, like Bigfoot or something. Or maybe it was just an early work draft at best. But there it was, sitting right in front of me. And I know what you're thinking, oh my dear brother, but I can tell you, your humble narrator did not take the easy way out. Geek to the gills as I was, I did not just dive into chapter 21. I read it from the first page to the last, and I didn't want to miss a thing. So, okay, you might be saying that's all well and good, but big deal. An extra chapter? First, good thing you're far away saying that, so I can't rip your face off. But more importantly, this 21st chapter has deep, deep significance and changes the story both literally and symbolically. Now, I'm going on the assumption that you've either read the book or seen the movie or both. And if not, you're lucky you're not here or I'd rip your face off. But the first 20 chapters are identical. Just like Alex, nothing changes. It's not until the 21st chapter that Alex and this novel grows. See, symbolically, 21 is the age of total maturity, theoretically. 21 is when a male is viewed as a man, and that's what Alex experiences himself in this chapter. Growth, maturity. And that's what was lacking in the previous incarnation. See, a character in a great piece of fiction should experience changes, growth. Otherwise, why are we on this trip? You know, it's like jerking off with no orgasm. Yeah, it's fun and a great way to spend a couple hours, but ultimately, what's the point? No one wins. In this final chapter, Alex experiences thoughts he never had before. He calms down. He's more passive. Thinks of having a family, and so on. But, and this is hugely important, his reluctance to resort to violence is by his own doing, not by force or brainwashing as in the first 20 chapters. And therein lies his growth, his arc, his maturity. Now, obviously, I'm just painting broad strokes here. If you haven't read it, go do it. And if you haven't read any of it, again, keep your face away from me. Growth and change is due to life experience or what is needed to truly achieve the concept we call maturity. But, you know, I've surpassed that chapter twofold and still want to crush, kill, destroy. So what do I know?
What I needed now to give it the perfect ending was a bit of the old Ludwig van.
Oh, bliss. Bliss and heaven. Oh, it was gorgeousness and gorgeousity made flesh. It was like a bird of rarest spun heaven metal, or like silvery wine flowing in a spaceship. Gravity all nonsense now. As I slush it, I knew such lovely pictures.
Oh, indeed, little Alex did love his Beethoven. But he wasn't the only droogie that had a penchant for the masters. No, another group of droogs definitely had a penchant for one of the killer bees. That being Johann Sebastian Bach. Bach loved to play games, and his favorite one was called Leading Astray. Every time Bach wanted to play this game, he had to put on a disguise. Legend has it that no other organist wanted to face off against him for fear of a shameful defeat. The rules of this musical challenge were such. One organist would begin to play a fugue, then halt at a challenging and unexpected place. The opponent, in turn, would have to take up the same fugue without skipping a beat. With each round, both organists would add complexity to the piece until one of them dropped the ball. Bach's departure from this world in 1750 may have well been the ultimate challenge of leading astray to all of those who followed. The composer left behind the Kunst der Fugue, a series of 12 fugues and 2 canons that remained mysteriously unfinished at the time of his death. Much debate surrounds Bach's reasons for leaving the piece unfinished, but many scholars believe that Bach filled the manuscript with hidden clues suggesting that the fugue's abrupt ending may have been open challenge for his successors to come up with a worthy conclusion. In May of 2008, Laibach rose to the challenge by releasing the album Laibach Kunstfugue, a reinterpreted and completed version of the Bach original. Prior to its release, the music on this new album had been performed just once in 2006 in a mystifying concert, translating roughly to concert for 4-player chess and 4 chess players in Bach's hometown of Leipzig, during a music festival dedicated to his works. Both Laibach and Bach have been known to leave coded messages in their work, much as Laibach has incorporated its symbol, an ominous symmetrical cross, into every album cover since its inception. And yes, there's even one on the cover of Vogue. Bach too embedded his name many times into the fugue. He accomplished this by employing gematria, a ancient numerical method in which numbers are used to replace letters in order to derive a word's revealed meaning. Bach's stamp is present everywhere. The tone sequence BACH frequently appears as the fugue subject, while Bach's number 14, which is B plus A plus C plus H, or 2 plus 1 plus 3 plus 8, appears under various guises on many different occasions, from the musical structure to the fugue's title, right down to the very last bar in contrapuntis 14, at which point the music cuts off abruptly at bar 239. As Bach scholar Indra Hughes observes in his thesis, Accident or Design, it is not by chance that the notes halt at that particular bar. For 2 plus 3 plus 9 equal 14. If Bach implanted secrets within his fugue, what secrets does Laibach mix into its own interpretation? For the last 25 years, the production of cover versions has become a standard element of Laibach Kunst and NSK. Nevertheless, due to the fact that in this case, we are not dealing with just a certain pop song or a single piece of visual art taken out of its original context, but with one of the most controversial classic masterpieces of its time and the full adaptation of that whole piece by Laibach. What might be the underlying meaning and hidden reverse of the fugue in a Laibach context?
Countdown. for Mars, and still we stand tall. 'Cause maybe they've seen us and welcome us all. With so many light years to go and things to be found, we're sure we all miss the sun. It's the final countdown.
Okay, kiddies, everyone take their seats now and listen up. We are about to begin today's lecture. Taking apart and tinkering with one's mind to create a new personality, does it work? Is a person truly good or evil if not acting upon their own will? That's these type of questions that are the focus of today's Black History Lesson. What type of personality are you? Extrovert? Introvert? Intelligent? Intuitive? Most likely a complex mixture of all the above. In the 1960s, experiments were done to attempt to pull personalities apart piece by piece. But when a personality comes apart, can it be put back together? Can you recreate the person or create someone new altogether? Henry Murray, a brilliant psychologist, was brought in by the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, precursor to today's CIA, to design psychological profiles on potential American spies. See, a lot of prospects look great on paper, but folded and completely collapsed out in the field. It was Murray's job to define and characterize these people's personalities, who they were, and how they behaved around other people. He wants to use testing to discern who's going to be good in dangerous situations, like spies, for example. Who's going to show leadership? Who's going to be stable even under the most tremendous pressure? So he designs his test to try and find those characteristics. His most successful tool is the Thematic Apperception Test, or TAT, a tool still in use today, some six decades later. Basically, individuals are shown a number of ambiguous images, all subject to numerous interpretations. The idea is for the person to come up with a story for the image, thus revealing some portion of their personality, their preoccupations, how they see things, and creating a personality profile from this. Murray and his assistant begin a wide-scale experiment using TAT and other personality exercises on 21 college sophomores. Through rounds of early testing, one young man appears to be a predictable conformist in every way, so much so that this test subject, a 17-year-old math prodigy, was given the moniker Lawful. At the end of the testing, Murray makes one more request for all to write a brief essay on their view of the world. So, A few days later, the subjects are brought back for what they are told is going to be a discussion on their personal philosophies. Instead, they are confronted with an aggressive interrogator trained by Murray to break apart and ridicule their core beliefs. Now, transcripts of these conversations are locked in the Harvard archives, but Murray's own scientific papers reveal it was confrontational, demeaning, and abusive. What Murray was trying to do was separate out the different parts of the personality to study each in isolation, which is a very typical way of working in science, to isolate the aspects you are most interested in. However, this is easier said than done when dealing with human subjects, because each part of one's personality is influenced by the other, so isolating a part entirely is not really possible. And can you influence one part without corrupting another? Now, Murray's intentions and what he was doing to these young men was not meant for any long-term harm, but attacking and belittling their core beliefs, well, there was no real way of knowing what effects it was going to have, long-term or otherwise. So the subjects were then made to watch the films of themselves being insulted during the interrogations. Students' heart rate, blood pressure, and skin tension were measured. The one called Lawful recorded the highest stress levels under questioning of any of the subjects. This was a very intense kind of interrogation, one where it's hard to imagine that anyone could go through this and come out completely undamaged. 3 years later, the experiment is finally over. Lawful graduates from Harvard with a PhD in math and gets a job teaching at Berkeley. And he also starts having violent nightmares. In 1969, he quits his job and moves to a simpler life in Montana. He becomes more and more reclusive, distancing himself from friends and family. He develops this philosophy based on the idea that civilization and technology are incompatible, that technology is ruining individual human freedoms. He comes to believe that modern science and industrialized society are evil. A math prodigy, so straight-laced he was named Lawful, decides the law isn't going to hold him back any longer. In 1978, he sends a package to an engineering professor at a campus university. It explodes when opened. This is the first bomb in a reign of terror that lasts 18 years. Targets are wide-ranging. Science and technology departments, airlines, any institution or group he sees as evil. Could the studies have driven him to this? Well, no one knows for certain. But a young man at Harvard so conventional he is referred to only by his codename Lawful is given a new codename by the FBI, the Unabomber. Real name, Ted Kaczynski. America's most notorious domestic terrorist. And that, my chillin, is today's lesson here at Bizarre Bazaar, where our interest in Black history lasts longer than a month. Yeah.
Others have simply been misguided.
smoke awoke something dark in the room.
Fight back! Fight back! Surrender's injection, so you're our final solution. Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit amphetamines.
Well, all right. It has become that time once again where I will bid adieu to all you bizarre freaks and fuckers out there. Please feel free to drop me a line, send me an email. Your thoughts on the show, ideas, something for me to ramble on about, whatever. So until next time, as Douglas Adams said to Jesus, so long, and thanks for all the fish.
As of the wedding day, anything that touches a pussy is off limits.